Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Anthony Cao. My guest today is Natasha Lance Rogoff. Natasha is an author, filmmaker, and TV producer. During the 1990s, she brought Sesame Street to post-communist Russia. Now, she has a book about that experience. It's titled Muppets in Moscow, published October 2022 by Roman and Littlefield. Muppets in Moscow offers a highly accessible, intimate, and captivating account of what it took to both transplant and translate Sesame Street into Ulitsa Sazam, as the show is known in Russian. It's a tale of kidnapping Elmo dolls, airlifting tree parts across the Atlantic, and Russian children ultimately falling in love with classic characters like Bert and Ernie, as well as new characters created for Ulitsa Sazam. Thank you, Natasha Lance Rogoff, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great summary.
Well, you know, as someone who's also fascinated by post-Soviet history and society, I really loved a book, found it a smooth read, so I'm really glad to be able to talk today.
Me too.
So in the book's introduction, there was something that jumped out as amusing to me. You mentioned how you changed your legal name from Susan to Natasha after getting obsessed with Russian literature. What in particular drew you to Russian culture back then, and what kept you hooked?
I think it was just the absurdity of the literature that I had read. You know, it was both mysterious, this other society, and somehow, you know, not influenced by consumerism in the same way that American society was. And then the soulfulness of the conversations that all the characters would have, you know, I felt like they were my people. You know, I kind of got sucked in, and it was also very, you know, both romantic and dark.
Interesting. And before you produced Ulitsa Sazam, you had spent a fair bit of time in the Soviet Union during the 80s, and you were getting to know artists, you were doing some freelance journalism and documentaries. What are some of your best memories from those times, and how did those experiences ultimately lead you to produce Sesame Street in Russia?
Well, I moved there when I was 22 years old as a foreign exchange student. There were about 30 Americans in both Moscow and in what was then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And it was part of our cultural exchange, you know, with the Soviet Union, because then, you know, it was communist society. And the exchanges were quite limited at that time. So there weren't that many Americans going over to live in Russia. So I felt, you know, very lucky to be there, and at the same time, fascinated by this other society, you know, that had a completely different economic system. And everywhere I went, you know, people would ask me, where is it better, you know, in America or in Russia? It was just like a constant refrain. Fascinating to meet with the underground rock musicians and cultural figures from that society who had a really difficult life at that time. Many of them had to deal with their music being banned. Rock and roll was illegal at the time, and they couldn't record their music. The state owned all the recording studios. They couldn't sell their music. And many of my friends had to pass their tapes, you know, it was cassette tapes. So this is all before digital content was created. And, you know, it was a really incredibly intimate and exciting, you know, time when concerts would pop up on their own and people would come after hearing about them from word of mouth. They would last about, you know, 30 minutes if you were lucky, and then the KGB would come and shut it all down. So it was, you know, very different from living in America at that time. And I think I just really fell in love not only with the culture, but also the struggle that people were experiencing to express themselves freely. And this also impacted the not only artists, but the LGBTQ community, which I wrote about, you know, at that time in 1983 for the San Francisco Chronicle. It was, you know, kind of as an American used to more freedoms. I'm not saying that everything is great in our own country, but I think it was at that time, the system itself, a centralized system, had its own inherent problems. And I, you know, was able to see how that impacted average Soviet citizens in their daily lives. Hmm.
And so you were hanging out with rock musicians, which does come up later in the book. But how did you get to that, from that to children's television? I think you also remark in the book that when you were first approached, you're like, well, wait a second, I haven't had a lot of experience in this particular domain. You know, how did you feel? How did you get on board?
Well, I really thought I was the last person in the world to, you know, produce this show in Russia. I mean, I had zero children's television experience. Most of my friends, you know, in film and TV did not have children. My sister had three children, and, you know, I wasn't even in a relationship. So when they asked me, there were two executives who approached me at a screening of my documentary film, which was about the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I had followed a steel worker, a police chief in charge of economic crime who was putting people in prison, and conservative fascists who would be willing to do anything to avoid the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And they were boisterously anti-capitalist and anti-Semitic. So I did not expect these, you know, Sesame Street executives to come up and say, would you help us, after looking at my film, take Sesame Street to Russia, bring the Russian children, the Muppets. I mean, it was kind of nuts, you know, and, I didn't know. I was sort of confused, but also really intrigued, because what they were trying to do was remarkable. I mean, this was during a period just after the fall of the Soviet Empire. There weren't that many children's programs for kids at that time in a post-Soviet society. There was very little television production going on because it was a period of extreme economic turmoil for the country, with the collapsing ruble. And also, you know, the break apart of the empire itself, where republics were splitting off and becoming independent countries like Ukraine and Georgia and Armenia. So when Sesame Street explained that they had bipartisan support from the U.S. Congress, and then Senator Biden had spearheaded approval of a Russian version of Sesame Street, I thought, wow, this could really make a huge impact in this country. And you know, it was a gift. I mean, when I look back on this time and think about how I was randomly drawn into this, and ultimately, as I write about in the book, you know, it changed my life and the life of millions of children. And it also led to me having my own children.
Right. And, you know, on the note of things like, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapsing ruble at that time, you go to Moscow amidst those circumstances, and your first task is to find a local investor. Talk a bit about what that process was like.
Yes. Well, that was not what I expected. By this point, I was working closely with Baxter Urist from Sesame Workshop, then called Children's Television Workshop, and Leonid Zagalsky, who was a very good friend of mine who lived in Moscow. He's Russian. He was a quite well-known Russian journalist. And we had to raise money for the show because the U.S. Congress wouldn't release the funding unless the Russians had some skin in the game and they were paying for half of it. Like it had to be matched, whatever funding we were putting in. So the first sponsor that we had hoped to snag, essentially, was Boris Berezovsky, who was a rising media mogul and he also ran a huge car company at the time. And it took us months to get a meeting with him. I mean, we would just ask everybody, oh, does anybody know him? Couldn't we meet him? You know, and finally we get a meeting with him and we explain to him how the Muppets, you know, would bring idealistic values of tolerance and freedom of expression to post-Soviet society, and we'd be building a whole new neighborhood and original Muppets, as you said, Anthony. And so, you know, he was excited by the idea, but he then asked, you know, is Big Bird going to be in the production? He was familiar with Sesame Street, and I was like, no, Big Bird won't be in it. We'll have an original puppet to replace Big Bird. And he seemed a little sad about that. I think he kind of liked Big Bird. I mean, even just the idea of sitting there and listening to this oligarch say Big Bird, I was very encouraged that we were on the right track. And much to our surprise, Berezovsky agreed to become a sponsor of the show. This was so thrilling for us. I mean, we did not anticipate that our first meeting with him would be this successful. But then 3 weeks later, you know, we had to process paperwork with his lawyers and everything. And 3 weeks later, I was back in the States for you know, after I finished that one trip. And my colleague Leonid called me and said, there's been an explosion. And Berezovsky's car was bombed and he was hurt. So we found out that he was burned over a large part of his body and he had to be treated in London, or at least we assumed that's where he was going. We didn't actually know. And that was the end of the deal with him. I mean, he survived and he went on to actually become the Russian president's key advisor later and was instrumental in bringing Putin to power eventually. But he had bigger things to take care of than supporting a children's puppet show, and he was no longer a possible partner for us.
Mm-hmm. And after Berezovsky, you talk about in a book how you end up finding a female lead investor, Irina Borisova, and I think Leonid describes her as a rare goose because female entrepreneurs at that time in Russia are not, you know, that common. You know, what are some of the challenges as well as maybe more amusing and rewarding moments as you were dealing with perhaps a more patriarchal business environment at that time?
Well, we were very, very lucky to find Irina as a partner. There were really two, I think, at the time that I knew of. Women running advertising agencies and production houses. And from the moment I met her, I mean, I wasn't sure if she had the money that she said she had, but I really thought her heart was in the right place. And rather than constantly asking me about, you know, the profit margins and, you know, from the advertising on either side of the show, because we weren't going to have advertising in the body of the show since it was for children, I really felt that this was something that she wanted to do not only for her 8-year-old daughter, but for the many children in her country. So that was, you know, very lucky to find her. And we became very good friends. I mean, even though there were enormous difficulties, challenges for her financially, and I write about it in the book, I think in a way that's also hilarious because this is not really how business is supposed to go. And, you know, but together as a team, I mean, we had 400 artists working on the show. That's puppeteers, writers, producers, filmmakers, set designers, actors. It was, you know, quite a diverse group of people. We had Russians, Ukrainians, Armenians, all kinds of people working together, you know, trying to create a different future for children.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm. And, you know, in assembling that diverse team, can you talk a bit more about that experience and some of the challenges and culture clashes that you faced?
Well, as you say, you know, you mentioned earlier about the patriarchal society. And, you know, it's ironic because the Soviet Union had many extremely progressive policies, like abortion was legalized in the 1920s. It was possible to divorce your husband as a woman without your husband present. And so, you know, at the same time, and we still see this today in the lineup of, you know, Putin's top officials, you know, it's like almost exclusively men. Not much has changed there. But, you know, when I took the job, I thought I'm going to build a team that is diverse. And we were able to hire more than 50% women. And we had many women in key technical roles. And my colleagues that I worked with thought this was stunning. They had never seen this before. And they were so competent, you know, so artistically brilliant. The set designer, if you see what the set looks like, I mean, it's out of this world. Probably next to the U.S. show, the most beautiful set ever built of a Sesame Street co-production. So you were asking me also, though, about the many challenges, I think, or...
Oh, yes. Let's talk about the challenges.
The challenges. There were a lot of, in addition to the violence that was going on, you know, mostly outside the studio and in the TV station, there were also cultural clashes between the American and the, you know, team of artists in Moscow. You know, the cultures were really different. And as a result, the developing a children's television show together meant that we were going to be butting heads on a number of artistic decisions. And, you know, to mention a few of them, you know, initially the Moscow creative team didn't like the Muppets. And they said that they wanted to use their own traditional Russian puppets. And the head writer reminded me that they had a revered puppetry tradition dating back to the 16th century, and they didn't need the American Muppets. And that debate went on for months until they eventually visited the U.S. And after meeting the U.S. puppeteers and seeing the set in Queens, in New York, and also the most, I think, transformational moment that convinced them was when a group of teenagers approached us when we were downtown in New York, and they saw the Bert and Ernie on the back of my black bomber jacket, and they came up and started yelling, "Yo, Bert and Ernie, my main man!" You know, like, you know, across the street, and then came up and started, you know, talking with the Russians about who were their favorite Muppets and what scenes they liked best. And when the Russians saw this, it was like the first time they understood the reach of Sesame Street, that this show could, you know, impact the lives of so many young people. So that was, you know, really, really amazing. But there were other challenges too, you know, not only around the puppets themselves, but also around the script writing. And initially, the scripts that we got in from the 40 or so writers were very abstract. They didn't include any physical comedy. Slapstick comedy was not funny necessarily to Russian audiences. They used a lot of wordplay that might have been too sophisticated for young children. And my favorite one was when one of the script writers submitted a script where the characters in the storyboard were mopping. One was mopping a floor, and then some text came on the screen and it said D for depression.
Yeah, that was a very, very amusing anecdote to read in a book.
Yeah, but there were other challenges too, because initially the group, the music director wanted to feature only classical music. And I understood where she was coming from, because most of the animated, incredibly brilliant, world-renowned animation that had been done by Soviet artists used classical music. So it made sense that she was saying that. But the idea of creating a new TV show, which, like Sesame Street, would include diverse, innovative music, is really what I was hoping for. And I thought would also make the show more popular, as well as give a lot of the rock musicians that had not had opportunities to express themselves an opportunity to write music for the show. So eventually, you know, maybe it's in Muppets in Moscow in the book about what happens, but it's quite a saga of you know, the way change happens. You get to see this happen in slow motion. And this is applicable to so many societies in Venezuela, in the Middle East. You know, how does a society that has been a closed society open up? How does it happen? And when it comes to puppets and children, it's an incredible, you know, very intimate view into the society.
Well, listeners, guess you'll have to open up the book and read it to find out exactly how Ulitsa Sazam helps open up a closed society. But, you know, talking about the book itself, what made you decide it was time to write Muppets in Moscow almost three decades after all of the events that we were just talking about?
Well, you know, I had written an early draft or notes just after the production aired, and it became a huge hit, and the show ran for over a decade across 11 time zones of the former Soviet Union, and it was seen by millions and millions of children. And I felt that it was just, you know, as the relations between the U.S. and Russia, or the West and Russia, deteriorated in the 2000s, you know, 2010, 2011, 2014, leading up to the invasion of Crimea, I just felt like we were missing something, and that this snapshot of this time taught so much that we needed to know today, as well as explaining some of the mistakes that we made along the way by trying to move things so quickly in Russia. So that was one reason. And then another reason was that every show I was watching on Netflix or on Amazon showed Russians as like thugs, criminals, prostitutes. And that didn't ring true to the, you know, incredibly artistic, brilliant, passionate people that I worked with, the artists who really were sacrificing so much to build a different country with different values.
So on a note of, you know, you talk about the invasion of Crimea, the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine happens in February 2022, and that must have been right as you were putting finishing touches on the book. To what extent did that affect your writing or the marketing of the book?
Well, it was heartbreaking. I mean, it was just heartbreaking to see this. And, you know, immediately I was on the phone on WhatsApp with my former colleagues, many of whom had been protesting and had been actively writing against the war, against the special operation on social media. And some of them had to get out within 24 hours of Putin passing the law against speaking out on social media against the war. So that was a very harrowing period, and shocking to see what was going on. There were also people I was speaking with who were in Ukraine, who had worked on the show, as well as people who are Ukrainian and lived in Moscow and didn't feel safe and had to move into like smaller villages, kind of go underground. So, you know, it's very sad. I think it's sad for the people in Russia who tried so hard to change their country. So many people got killed, you know, who were trying, great men and women. At the same time, you know, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning one morning, and I realized that the, you know, the more than a million young men and women who are leaving Russia, in the case of the men, because they don't want to fight in the war. And, you know, for the 20 and 30 year olds, they don't want to support the war. And they are Sesame Street's generation. I mean, they grew up on our show. So, you know, that's the legacy that I feel we left. And that's the same for the Ukrainians who are fighting for their independence, who also grew up on the show and are the same age cohort now.
Mm. Yeah, and I hear that there's rumblings of like a Ukrainian Sesame Street that's maybe getting produced. So perhaps there is
something going on right now, because Sesame Street has been creating content which is being used by Ukrainian refugee children. But that would be wonderful. But I also think that if we get the chance again in Russia, which I hope we will, that we will be able to come back and Zeli Boba, Kubik, and Businka, the Slavic Muppets, will be able to laugh with millions of children again.
Yeah, we can only hope that the situation will improve, and, you know, Sesame Street will be able to return to Moscow and Russia yet again. Well, thank you so much, Natasha Lance-Rogoff. This was an enlightening conversation. Listeners, if you want to learn more about Natasha's experiences and find out what happens with all of the twists that she had talked about, make sure to check out her book, Muppets in Moscow, from Roman and Littlefield. Thank you very much again, Natasha, and take care.